Hello, welcome to Game Changer Mindset Podcast, where we explore the minds behind high performance. My name is Roberto Ghiodelli, and in this episode, we are thrilled to have Per Norgren, a distinguished teaching partner, mentor, and supervisor at the Oxford Mindfulness Foundation. With a background in IT executive management, Per's encounter with mindfulness led him to explore its profound impact on both personal and professional aspects of life. Per brings a wealth of experience in teaching mindfulness-based leadership training at many organizational levels. His expertise extends to fostering effective team building through mindfulness and teaching resilience to stress, anxiety, and anger. Per, welcome and thank you very much for joining us here.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Yes. Per, first of all, I'd like to know a little bit about your personal journey from an IT executive to becoming deeply involved with mindfulness.
Could you share? So I spent 23 years in the IT industry. The last 10 years I was in kind of senior management positions and the director for the delivery of large-scale projects and programs across Europe, and looking after professional services, customer service, and implementation and training and things. And it involved working very long hours, weekends, and away from home a lot. It's had a profound effect on my health and well-being and my family and everything. So it was not very good. And so the family broke down and in the midst of it all. After that, I was a bit vulnerable and I soldiered on because where I come from, you know, the weakness is not acceptable. And so you just work through it. And one day I couldn't do it anymore. I'd hit the end and I experienced firsthand what it is like to have, where you fall apart. And it was a completely new experience for me. Well, I'm Swedish and I'm coming from a time and place where mental illness was not considered something important. There was stuff that happened to old people far away. I didn't know anyone with mental issues. I probably did, but we just had no idea. I'd never spoken about it. I had no idea. No, nothing.
How old were you when you had this little...
I must have been in my late 40s. Yeah, so I'm 64 now, and this happened about 15 years ago or something, I think. Yeah, so I couldn't do it no more, and I fought on, and I had a colleague that had been institutionalized, and I kind of always laughed about it because he had a certificate that he was sane. Because after he'd been, because he had a similar situation actually. And it's never dawned on me that actually I did know somebody that had had some difficulty, because he got so bad. So he got taken into care. And after 6 months, they let him back out. I mean, this is his story. I don't know how it was, but this is what he's saying, that after 6 months, I was declared sane. And I actually have a certificate of sanity. So he was allowed out. I thought that it was brilliant. I have a certificate that I'm sane. And so I was really frightened. This idea of being locked up and taken into care, at least they were like, I was not even on, no, it's not going to happen. No matter what, it's not going to happen. So by chance, I came across MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and I enrolled on the course straight away, and it changed my life. completely. It was absolutely magical how it changed me. And it saw me through. So it took me 7 months to get through that dark period of my life. I did what little work I could. I could sit for days at work just doing nothing, just staring at the computer screen and just ruminating, just thinking and holding on to in between panic attacks and anxiety attacks and things. And it was thoroughly unpleasant. And I think the worst experience was I slept very little. And middle of the night, 2-3 o'clock, I was lying there ruminating and worrying and things. And I had one thought. One thought just popped into my mind about something terrible. And I just felt this adrenaline rush, like as if I was, I don't know, doing a super competition in something. And it just like have to give it 100%. And my heart started beating and I felt a huge rush of energy. And I sat up and took my pulse and it was over 180. Wow. And it's gone from normal to 180 by one thought in the middle of the night. I mean, it's pathetic. This stuff doesn't happen to me, but it did. And it's real. It does happen. I was using the techniques of mindfulness-based stress reduction and listening to the founder of that, Jon Kabat-Zinn, his recordings, and I gradually found my way through it using those techniques, and I deployed them. And it was magic. It was magic. I started to be able to confront my fears, confront the issues, the difficulties, and in the end, I was okay with them. And, you know, I can face this. And once I have kind of dealt with all of it through these 7 months, I was like I came out of a dark forest and in through a gate and into open fields and just clear sky, sunshine. I could breathe. It was wonderful. And I became suitably very enthusiastic about mindfulness. And I tried to tell everyone about it. And this was the best thing ever. And you should do it. And yeah. And I then tried to figure out what had happened to me because I was a new person, different person. I was kind and considerate. And I was, it was weird. And I could be in meetings back at work and I see everybody shouting and screaming about something gone wrong. And I was just sitting there watching the mayhem and I was the only one being calm. And I was the only one that could come up with a solution. And so I would raise my hands many times and say, stop, this is what we're going to do. And I'd worked at that. I was the only one that could think. Everybody else were going on about how bad it was and whose fault it was and how stupid everyone was and particularly whose fault it was. I was in amongst people that would focus on that rather than fixing the problem. And it's a particular mindset and it's not conducive to creativity and thinking, strategic thinking, of course. It was amazing. So I started learning to teach with Bangor University and on their kind of, they did the degree program, but they also did for the people that couldn't commit to being at Bangor. Of course, everything was in person back then. There was no thought about online stuff then. So you had to be available. And of course, I wasn't. I was working on Europe and the Middle East. So I had to – so they had a program where you could actually do all the modules, do them in your own time. And that's what I did. So whenever I could, I went and did a module and then did another module and until I'd done enough modules, I could start teaching. And so I taught while I was still working at the weekends and things. And then after a year or so, we had something upheaval happen at work, and yeah, some big changes, some big investment people coming in, and I got a bit derailed at work, and I got a bit disillusioned. But I dealt with it amazingly well because I could ground myself and think clearly what is the best thing I can do for myself now and for the company, rather than scream and shout about my new role within the company. And I said, you know, I can help them a bit, and I can help myself, so I can use this time to transition into full-time teaching. And I did. So instead of quitting on the spot and calling them all the names under the sun, then I said, all right, let's go with this and see what happens. And I secretly started planning to get out of there. And 7 months later, I think it was, or 11 months or 9 months or whatever, I officially retired from IT and went into teaching mindfulness full time. And it was the best thing I ever done. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing this experience. I mean, I was thinking the transition itself was very conscious. It was a mindful transition, as you said. Sometimes it happens that we just have to react to situations, and sometimes we explode and we have to. And, you know, sometimes it's not wrong and sometimes it's okay. But, I mean, mindfulness proposition is to be more like that, you know, when you are more aware of what is going on, we can deal with things in a really smooth way, right? So,
yeah.
And I was thinking when you shared, like, nowadays, I think we've been talking more and more about mental health, like that. And, especially because the world, everyone feels like they need to take care of it. And it was not as like that, like 15 years ago or so. I think it's really important that you said that, you know, it took you months. It was not like that. It was like magic, mindfulness, getting to know this because you had never had contact with it, but it took a while and it took practice, right? Could you talk a little bit about this? Because it's not something like this. You go, you do one practice and that's it.
Right? Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, it is. I mean, think about mindfulness. What do we mean by mindfulness? It's once you know mindfulness, you realize that mindfulness is kind of an umbrella term. It's a bit like saying sport. I do mindfulness. Yeah, I'm mindful. Yeah, I do sport. But actually, what do you do? Do you do cycling, running? You know, it's like, so the same with mindfulness. So what do you actually do? Well, so I was, at the time, I was learning how to deal with difficulties. And that was my main aim. I wasn't particularly involved or thinking about developing the better ability to cope with physical pain, or a better way of critical thinking, or a better way of compassion, or, you know, all these different areas of mindfulness. So I was focusing it just to be able to cope through all these horrible thoughts and things that came up for me. And it's a particular practice. And we teach it in, you know, MBSR and MBCT and MBCTL. We teach it in that. So it's a well-known practice. And once you learn the technique, and this is the beautiful thing about mindfulness, is that particularly for dealing with the difficulty, is it, once you start knowing how to do it, suddenly stress reduces. Because you're not affected by these thoughts that pop up. So it's okay. So you're starting to feel better. You start to eat better. You start to sleep better. And it's kind of slowly, slowly, like a super tanker turning, you know. It's like the more you practice, the more you learn how to do this particular technique, the more your life suddenly start to open up and become richer and richer, and you started noticing things, being able to think clearly, make better decisions. And it's quite remarkable because We know now that in the background of your mind, your subconscious will always go on worrying about things, sorting things out. We call it a default mode network, and this is what the mind does when it does nothing. In other words, when we're not particularly focused on anything, then the mind doesn't stop. It's very busy sorting out all the unfinished business, all the issues, all the problems and everything. So that's whirring away in the background. And if you got lots of these unfinished business, lots of worry things, you're going to be exhausted. Because even though you've done particularly nothing, you might have just, I don't know, relaxing or watching TV, reading or whatever, but you're still feeling exhausted. Like at the end of the day, you feel, I haven't done anything today, but God, I'm tired. That's a typical sign of that the mind has been whirring away in the background. So by being able to meet thoughts that are troubling you, and not only just getting used to them, but actually resolving them, resolving your response to them. That's the key difference between typically some common therapy, where you're trying to look at things in a different way, or the person didn't mean that, can I see it like this? Or, so try to put that in a different context, that particular issue. Whereas this way of doing it is one framework that fits all issues, because we're not concerned with what has happened, who did it, when it happened, or how badly injured you were, or whatever it was. We are dealing with your, how did I react to it? Now, can I meet that difficult thought in a different way and bring myself to have a more helpful response? Then I can deal with any thought, whatever it is. And this is the key. So once you get used to knowing that framework and make it available to the brain as a choice when a difficulty happens, and it starts with that you kind of, you know about it, you practice it a little bit, and you react, and a few minutes or day after or whatever it is, you come to realize, oh, I shouldn't have said that. I should have reacted like this instead. So, okay, so you think about it and you do the action. And then next time, well, maybe it's only take a minute before you realize, oh, I should have done that. And until one day it comes to that the mind actually says, well, you know what? I have a choice here. I either go ranting and raving and screaming and shouting about it, or I pause for a minute and I have a think about it. I know it's unpleasant. I know this is not right. I know that this is not what should happen. But you know what? I'm going to have a think about this and then decide what I do. What's best for me? What's best for the company? What's best for the people involved? And that place is the most wonderful place to be in, because you are now in control of what happens. You are in charge. So you decide what happens next. And that's rather beautiful. And it doesn't matter how difficult the situation is, or how nasty the person is, or how much frightening you have, or whatever it is, anger you have. If you can pause and have a decision, it's a huge sense of freedom. I decide to run away, or to say nothing, or to fight, or it's my decision, I decided. So you have the option then. And that's wonderful. And I wish everybody could have that, because it reduces stress tremendously.
It's like a superpower, right? Once you get it, you can see things from a higher perspective, and you, I mean, at the same time, it's not like when I work with my groups, I say, okay, it's not going to happen all the time. You know, sometimes you can get caught, but act impulsively. But once you get the gist of it, it's going to, you know, slowly and slowly, it gets easier. And still, we still have to practice. It's something So mindfulness is something that you have, it requires some discipline, right? What do you think about this? Because when people participate in groups, okay, we always give guided meditations, guided practice, formal and informal practices. What, in your, according to your point of view, your experience, how important is the frequency of practices?
Yeah, the importance of practice. We can't underestimate or understate that. It's really, really important. Because you need to keep it alive. Because habits creeps in all the time. The best example of habits creeping in and how to avoid habits creeping in is next time you fly, you walk up the steps into the airplane, you give the airplane a little pat on the outside and say, deliver me or to transport me safely here. And then you walk in and you always look left, see if the door into the cockpit is open and you can see all the buttons and all the people sitting there, the pilot and the co-pilot sitting there. And pilot sitting there with a checklist. And this is a guy that's flown maybe 40,000 hours. He transported millions of passengers for 20 years, and he still can't remember what to do. Let me off this airplane. I'm not flying with somebody that doesn't know what he's doing. You know, I need to take another flight with another airline. This is not good. But we don't react like that. We take great comfort in that, thank heaven, he's checking up that everything is okay. And so they know that habits comes in. So that's why he has a checklist, so he doesn't forget anything. So this is what happens in our life, that we forget to be mindful because we don't practice it. So it's there, but we need to keep it alive. So we can do this in many different ways. You know, there's lots of different practices we can do. But it's really important to distinguish here between the longer practices that will change the structure of your brain. And the shorter practices that you can deploy in the moment. So one is like paracetamol and one is like surgery. Okay. So if we think of it like that, so we learn many, many tricks, many little short things that we can use in the moment to calm down, to get better focus, to sleep better, all kinds of little tricks. And they work wonders. And they do keep the mindfulness alive, of course, and we get better at them the more we do them. But really, to really deepening the feeling and work towards an openness and comfort and living it with joy, then you need to do the longer practices. And so both have a purpose and both are important. And so I wouldn't recommend skipping on either of them. Because you're not getting the whole picture unless you do the practices. Yeah. But once you've learned it, you know how to do it, so you just get on with it. And Jon Kabat-Zinn famously taught us that, because he was much into yoga. He did lots of yoga. There's a based, mindfulness-based stress reduction that's got a lot of yoga in it. And you always say that the most difficult move in yoga is to roll out the mat. Once you roll out the mat, rest is easy. You're on it and you're doing it. But that procrastination, you see the mat in the corner of the room, and oh, I know I should be doing it, but I'll have a cup of tea first. And you never do it. So it's the same with sitting down and doing the meditation practice. Just do it, like a famous sports company said. Just do it.
Just do it. Don't think much about it.
Yeah.
Start. Yeah, the first step is the hardest usually. Yeah. Wow. What about your practices? How could you share with us your personal practices? How, because for people who know mindfulness, have different formal practices. You have body scan. We have, you know, we can listen to, we can some moving practices.
Yeah.
I mean, what are your favorite ones and what is your routine with this?
Yeah. I do a range of different practices, of course. I'm teaching a lot. So I practice during the teaching. And But apart from that, my personal practice involves gratitude. We teach that in the courses as well. And I come to see that it's really, really important. And I do a gratitude practice in the morning, gratitude practice in the evening. And whenever I have a chance during the day, I have a gratitude practice. So that's really important for me to feel, because it changes my mindset from worry into appreciation. And when I'm in that mindset, a lot of tension goes. And once the tension goes, I can think clearly. So that's really important. All throughout the day, I also do breathing exercises. And I focus on belly breathing. So whenever I can, I would take, I'm sitting and driving or walking, whatever, I will zoom in on my belly and do belly breathing. I'm doing it while I'm doing some other things. And then a sitting down practice would be that I've been practicing now for maybe 4 or 5 years coming in. It's a practice from a book called The Mind Illuminated. It's by a fellow called John Yates, and Kuladasa is his Buddhist name. It is based on Buddhism, but he was also a neuroscientist and a Buddhist scholar. And so he wrote a book about it. And it's a 10-step program, and it requires you to know meditation first, maybe done a course and you're familiar with the concept, you're familiar with doing it. So you have some experience with it, and then the book will make sense. And it takes you on a 10-step journey to living with joy. And I don't think I'm quite going to get to Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama level, but if I get halfway there, I'll be very happy. And the practice is there. You see, you come through the normal practices like the body scans and the sitting with open awareness and sitting on focusing on just something like the breath or something. You do all these practices as part of it. And then to the later stages of the program, you come into specific practices for where things turn a little bit more quiet and you start allowing joy to emerge. And it's quite remarkable practices. You get just filled with this wonderful feeling of hard to describe, actually. It's very pleasant. And it is, just feeling of contentment, gladness, happiness. Yeah, you truly feel joy from within. And the more you do it, the longer it lasts after the practices. So this is the key. So once you've done it often enough, it's then your default way of being is the reasoning behind this. So I got some way to go yet.
Wow, that's great. Thank you for sharing, because I guess each one of us, even mindfulness teachers, they had their own practices and also some extra influences that do not only come from mindfulness, other meditations. And thank you for sharing that book and that author. So so everyone here will be able to access these two, and maybe they will get identify themselves with this. I will do this for sure. Okay. So it's great to know about your own practices and your own experience with mindfulness. And I would like to know now about your experience as a teacher, as a mindfulness teacher. And we know that most usually we teach, your facilitators teach in groups. We also, of course, private teaching too, but most of the time this is done in groups. And I think I have my point of view, but I'd like to know from you, how crucial do you think it is to have this model or this structure of participating in a group? I think when you did mindfulness first, it was in a group, right? MBSR. Yeah. Or MBCT, I don't know.
Yeah, so it's very interesting that I do teach one-to-one. for coaching and mentoring. And also, if people can't come to a group, I would do one-to-one sessions. Or sometimes I do family settings, you know, if relationship issues dealing with. So, but the group setting, yes, this is really, really important, I think, because what we notice is that a lot of learning coming from the other students. And why is that? If you think about it, I have learned how to deliver the course, a curriculum. It has a start and has a finish, and it's to set the agenda in the course. So it's not, when I teach a mindfulness course, it's not me making it up on the fly. It is actually very well, you know, developed, and it's been tested millions of times, well, not millions, but hundreds of thousands of times. You know, MBSR has been taught, or MBCTL, or MBCTE, or all these courses. So, and they've been very well researched. So when we go learn to teach mindfulness, we are taught how to deliver it. And if we deliver it according to the curriculum, what happens then is that the research tells us, as long as the participant do the homework, we can predict what's going to happen at the end, mm-hmm. to a large extent. There's a very high probability that they will benefit from it. Whereas if I just went off and taught something what I felt like on the day, we can't know for sure what would happen because it hasn't been done before. So this is very, very key that A, we have a course with a structure. And then you have to then think about that. But that's my course. That's my understanding of the course as a teacher. And I sprinkle that with my own experiences. But we have 16 individuals in the class, each having very different experiences from me. And each maybe are affected by issues that are very different to the issues that I was experiencing. So at the same time in the classroom, because everybody makes the course their own. And my job as a teacher is to make sure that in their own space or in their own environment, in their own context, they can load the form or the form of the course in and make it theirs. And this particularly happens during the inquiry process. This is a process that happens after an exercise, after a practice, where we go through and see, so how did it go? What did you learn? How did you feel about it? And what happened? How did you react? And now people are sharing. And each and everyone is telling their story about what happened to them when they did the practice, when they did the homework, what they discovered. And the range is huge. So if we've done a practice where we're looking for, how did it feel in the body? Some people feel it in the head. Some people feel it in the stomach. Some people feel nothing at all. Some people thought, well, that wasn't a problem at all. It was the other person's fault, or whatever the exercise might be, because we are so different. And as a teacher, I could never cover all scenarios in a course. So every student on the course are my co-teacher, showing and sharing of what has happened, so we can all learn from each other. And every time I teach, I learn a lot because I'm not fixed and rigid on, oh, this is how it should be. You should only say this, da, 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 da. Like it often can become if it is a lecture or I have very little of my own experience. So I have to rely entirely on the framework of the course. And you must do exactly as it says, otherwise it won't work. You don't have to at all. It will work. Just do it like this. Because if you have an experienced teacher that actually know it from inside out, he can adapt. He can see that in this situation, then, but if you do it a little bit slightly different, it will still work. So the group setting, I think, is that you will learn so much more if you come to a group setting, be much richer, and you will enjoy it lots. So that I definitely prefer the group over the one-to-one setting, yeah.
And also, yeah, I totally agree with your answer. And others, as you said, we have extra teachers, and that sense of, I'm not the only one who has anxiety issues. So once the other participants notice that they are not the crazy ones, or okay, so I belong to this, I can identify myself with others, even though it's not exactly the same situation, I can see that, I'm not alone in this. So this sense of common humanity, let's say.
Oh, geez. Completely, yeah. Absolutely. And you learn that in the group, that it's actually normal to feel bad about things.
Yeah.
It is. That's how it is. That's how the brain works. And there's nothing wrong with me. And John Kabat-Zinn said something really famous once. We have to put it in context. Where he worked, where he developed this, was in the basement of the hospital, University Hospital. And he took on the patients that medicine could no longer help, the end of the road people. Literally, that was, you're going to have to learn to live with this for the time you have left. That was it. You go and see John in the basement. That was literally was the answer. And he always said, as long as you breathe, you're okay. We can work with you. And he did. He literally did that. And that kind of ethos, that kind of concept, this, that kind of way of working, I think is so wonderful. Because it means that, yes, if you have the willingness and you have the energy to actually do the practices, you will benefit from it. And it doesn't matter where you are, who you are. So I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah. I like it. Because when we are in a bad mental state, we feel like we are different from, separate from everyone. Like, this is not for me. Or this will not even work for me, you know? So, so saying that as long as you're breathing, like, you're welcome and we're going to do something and we're going to work with you. Awesome. Per, I'd like to know, so the Game Changer podcast, the idea is to delve into this performance, high performance things, achievements, also sports. I'd like to know your experience with sports, even sport, I don't know if sport teams or but athletes, and how do you think mindfulness can benefit them?
Yeah, so there's a number of aspects actually coming into this. The two biggest one is something you, the most basic one of them, I had one person I worked with that was, he was shooting, skeet shooting, so these clay pigeon shooting. And he wasn't at the Olympic level, but he was high up in the county levels, and he lost it. He just couldn't do it no more. Something was wrong. And so he tried everything. Hypnosis, he'd been therapy, he's done everything. And he lived not far from me. So he kind of emailed me one day and said, is there anything you can do for me? I've tried everything. And I said, well, let's have a look. I said, so you're breathing, aren't you? So let's. So we met up and I thought I'll teach him, the standard MBSR, MBCT course for just one-to-one and he'll be fine. But it quickly transpired that he was, as a person, very tense. And this tenseness came from his childhood and his upbringing, which meant to him that when the result of that was that he was very hard on himself, very demanding of himself. And the sad net effect of that was that he was also like that with his family. He was very demanding, very hard on the family, his children and his wife. And now, what happens when you go around with grudging like that all the time? You're very tense. So it turned out that he couldn't breathe. He was so tense, and it's kind of sneaked up on him over the years. So he was so tense. He was holding his belly in. He's holding a tight chest. So if you think of breathing in the three stages of rest and relaxation comes from the belly breathing, the free movement of the abdomen can only happen if you're totally relaxed. Typically, when you go to bed, you're lying on your back, the belly moves freely. And lo and behold, the nervous system that, that tells us that we are in rest situation, it goes to the belly. And it listens to your belly breathing. So he didn't do that. Now, what happens next is that you go into fight or flight breathing, chest breathing. So you start heaving your chest. You are stressed. You're under pressure. So he couldn't even do that. So he ended up with kind of panic breathing, which is when you lift your shoulders to expand your lungs upwards. And he's like, you really don't want to do that because your neck muscles are not meant for shifting your shoulders up and down all day long. So you get tired as well as getting very stiff neck, but you end up breathing very shallow, like little teacup size breath. And you're not ventilating properly. You're not airing out your CO2. You're not getting oxygen properly. And you're tense. So it was apparent straight away that he was so tense he couldn't breathe. So the first couple of lessons, we just spent on breathing exercises. So I'm a yoga teacher. So I know how to teach pranayama, the yogic way of breathing. And it includes many different breathing exercises. And we particularly focus on release and let go of the abdomen. And from there, the chest and then the shoulders. And so he started to release. And the net effect of that was he started to relax. So now, once he started to relax, he could start breathe properly, he could think clearly. So now we could start dealing with the inner critic and how he was attacking himself. After each shot that he missed or wasn't as good as he wanted it to be because he had very high expectation, every shot should just be a cloud of smoke. And so once he could start dealing with that and he could start letting go of that inner critic a little bit, he transformed, completely transformed into something that after 6 or 7 lessons, he was invited to Sunday dinner with his mother-in-law. And he told me this in the lesson, the next session, that something remarkable had happened, he said, because my mother-in-law took my wife to the side and asked her, what's wrong with him? He's nice. And literally like that.
Wow.
And it has completely changed his life. It changed the life of his, everybody around him, his family, his children, and he could start performing again. And it was all sitting, it started with his breathing. But at the net result of being very hard on himself, it came from his childhood, which gave him a huge inner critic and high expectations. So, and this inner critic can take its forms of two ways. So like I've been working with somebody who was cycling and had huge self-doubts. So and it developed this out of the blue as well. I never used to have this. And then suddenly the self-doubts come in. And the what would happen is that when he started facing the tougher part of the race, he started not... His mind went the route of, oh, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do this. I'm not, it hurts too much. So recall this critical thinking then reduced his ability to perform. Whereas before he would just fight through whatever he needed to do to get to the finish line and just positively talk himself through what was happening. So this negativity, this self-talk that we have inside us, It's true for everyone, golf players, runners, anyone that's in sport, ice hockey players, basketball players, anyone. That if you don't believe in what you're doing, if you're starting to develop these self-doubts, doesn't matter how technically good you are at what you're doing, you are going to miss. You're not going to make it. And there's a lot of different practices we can do for A, reducing the self-talk, B, make the self-talk more nicer, and C, focus on encouragement and actually performance. So I don't know, does that make sense at all?
Totally, totally, yes. And we know that there are great athletes in sports world practicing mindfulness. They or have practiced. There are many stories. And yeah, once you start developing this inner awareness and learning techniques on how to be more in control, let's say, of your responses, it's going to help them amazingly. I mean, when I think about it, you know, it doesn't have only to do with their performance, because when you think of mindfulness for higher performance, but it's like it's a byproduct, you know. Of course you can focus on the on your performance, but then it's not that you have to, but eventually you add this to your whole life. Like you said, when you were talking to his mother-in-law it reaches your whole, all the aspects of your life, right?
Yeah, it does. And I think if you're looking at elite performance within sports people, of course, it's so visible. It is, and nowhere more visible than in golf, when the guy is leading with the last hole is leading with six strokes or something, you know, and fall apart completely. He put three balls in the lake, and you know, he misses five putts, and he's like, he doesn't know what's up and down on the club. It completely lost it, and we've had many, many instances of that over the years of golfers falling apart, and they don't seem to learn. And it happens the same again and again. Next year, he's coming back and doing well, and then fall apart on the last one. And it is once that self-doubt and that critical thinking creeps in, particularly over something that absolutely requires ultimate precision, a lot of exertion, it's going to go wrong, definitely.
Wow, this is... it happens in so many, I think in all kinds of sports, because once you, nobody believes you, you are like, nobody expects you to win, it's kind of easier to get there. But once the pressure is on you, right? And how to deal with these thoughts, and also to build this confidence. There are so many examples. The athlete or the team is winning, and okay, he's going to be the champion, and suddenly they start to lose, and they don't know.
And I think what was really important when you're performing is that the thoughts will come in. I mean, we mustn't fool ourselves that the thoughts they will come. They are. They, you know, it's part of being human. excuse me. We do have these thoughts. But if we have cultivated a bit of kindness to ourselves, these thoughts will not be so bad. That's the first thing. But, sorry. But when the thoughts comes in the critical moment of you going to do something, then you have a way of dealing with it so it doesn't affect your performance. And indeed, it can actually enhance your performance, because if you have a thought that gives some energy, you can then take that energy and add it to the energy you need for performing your task. So actually, a bit of extra adrenaline, a bit of extra get up and go, and it's a welcome thing that if you are doing a performance sport. So it's not a bad thing. You know, it's there to enhance our performance. It's part of fight or flight. To have that boost when you need it. You have to think of it. It's a bit like Formula One cars where they have a button where they can press the takeover button that gives them an extra boost. That's how it is. Instead of giving you a puncture and derailing you, actually it gives you a boost instead. So it's just a different way of working with your neural system. So, I hope, does that make sense at all?
Totally. Yes. Yes. It makes a lot of sense. And you also have experience with teams and with leadership, working with leaders.
Yeah.
It also applies to high performance professionals in other areas. They don't want to make the most of it. You know?
So, yeah.
When talking about leadership, because there are so many things we can talk about, but what do you think it's one or two aspects that you feel, okay, this is so important for them, or this is something that they feel that they miss and they should invest on it?
It's important to think about in leadership situations. Because mindfulness applies in all areas, all levels of an organization or a team. But particularly at the leadership level, it's really important because it allows the leader to lead and not be reactive. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking for is that the leader can give feedback in a constructive way, can give encouragement in a productive way, keep the goal in his mind, kind of a clear way, and not be clouded by emotions. Once you have emotions coming in to the leader, and they starting to looking at what's the impact of losing to me and my team, or what's the impact of not hitting the goals for the company or the department or my group or the division or whatever I am now the manager for or leader for. Once you start to personalize that and internalize this ruminative thinking about, oh, this is going to be terrible, I'm going to lose my house, I'm going to lose my wife, I'm going to do that, blah, 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 blah. So you lose ability to think about actually, what is it I'm trying to achieve here? And once you mindfully start aligning what you do with goals and values in your personal life and starting the ability to see things clearly, now you can be effective. And now people coming in are no longer a threat. They are an asset to you. So you can lead in a completely different way. You can be a visionary. You can see things. And one of the things that have often been cited and tested and researched is the brain's ability to creative thinking when we practice mindfulness. And it's quite clear that if we are less stressed, less tense, less contraction of muscles, the brain is free to think. And the brain is hugely creative, but most of the time it spends worrying about stuff and trying to fix things rather than actually come up with solutions. So this aspect of mindfulness, I think, is really, really important for leaders, that they are the ones that need to be able to have creative thinking. So when does it go wrong for a leader? It's when they start trusting the people around them too much without actually being able to see through it all. So because you don't know what the agendas of the people you are trusting are. They would have a personal agenda. So why they do things? So it's really, really important for the leader to be able to lead clearly, have a clear vision, and get people around him to have the same agenda as him and not go off on a tangent, on a personal vendetta or very personal agenda for when it is coming to business or teams.
So important, because the leaders influence the whole group, the whole team, and the whole project. And
yeah,
they have such they have such an impact. So if they are more mindful, it will influence its employees or the whole team.
That's
Well, thank you very much for your availability here and for being here and sharing some of your knowledge. And I'm pretty sure you have lots to talk about and some many things you could share.
Yeah.
I would like to know if someone is interested in taking some courses or groups with you, where they could contact you or reach you, if you could send us.
Yeah, the best is probably, I got a little web page and I put my courses up there and retreats and things I do. And it's called InMindSight.com. And the courses I teach for the Oxford Mindfulness Foundation, I also put links up there. So my common courses are up there. And then, whatever else I do is there as well. So, all welcome to contact me or go on my mailing list. I send out a monthly email and just give people an update on what's happening and what I'm doing. So, yeah. I'd love to hear from everyone. So, yeah, thank you.
I will put this link once it's the webcast, this podcast is posted in the social media. They will have access to this link. And, okay, thank you very much. Is there any final message you could share with us regarding maybe the future of mindfulness or, a final message we could finish in the
I think the message we can take away here is that as the world is getting more and more difficult with the nature and whatever happens in around us, uncertainty, jobs and fighting and wars and things, I think it's critical for people to be able to distance themselves from their thoughts, because it's very easy to get worried about all these things that's happening now and spend your time brooding and ruminating on that, where you've got a life to live. Every breath is your life, and that breath never comes back. And before you know it, you're 64 years old and wonder, where did it all went? Wait, what happened? It's all gone. And you're sitting and thinking, well, it's about time I started to live. And actually start noticing things, enjoying just being. And this is it. When we're moving from, it has to be special to be enjoyed, and there has to be something awesome, there has to be a fancy restaurant, there has to be like an amazing thing we go and see. No. Enjoy life just as it is. Whatever you do, then that's life. Life doesn't happen somewhere else. Life happens inside you. And that's the place to live. So that's the focus, I think. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. There's no comments. That's it. You send it off. Yes. Thank you very much, Per. And I hope we have some other opportunities, because I'm sure we have lots to talk about mindfulness and all these things that the world needs it. We all need it. Not like the world. We need it. We need to cultivate this and to have the quality of life.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you so much, Roberto. Lovely to be here. And thank you again. Thank you so much.